Hello, and welcome back to the 3 a.m. Mystery Club podcast. I'm Brandon, and you might remember me from the time I was featured in Soap Opera Digest.
I'm Ro, and wake up, campers. It's a glorious morning. Today is evaluation day. The key word here is value. Do you have any? Not yet, but by the end of the summer, this camp is going to be full of skinny wieners.
And I'm Derek, and Bob Saget can get it.
It's my turn tonight, and in typical Brandon fashion, I've got a pretty horrifying story for you guys. This one isn't exactly one of our typical full episode mysteries. As you'll gather, it's pretty clear who committed these crimes, but the story is just so compelling I couldn't pass it up. There is an element of mystery at the end, though, so it still follows Mystery Club guidelines, technically. And also, I feel like this story should be more widely known, and maybe it is, but when I stumbled onto it from a random story on Facebook, I had never heard of it. When I started reading about it, I was completely sucked in. So brace yourselves, and allow me to tell you the story of what might be Indiana's most prolific serial killer, Herb Baumeister. In the early 1990s, gay men in Indianapolis started to disappear. By 1995, 10 men had been reported missing after going out to gay bars during summer months in a large Indiana city. And like a lot of our cases, this was the early to mid-90s. So law enforcement and sadly sometimes families didn't think much of it if a gay man suddenly went missing. But the gay community in Indianapolis took notice. People began making flyers and hanging them at and around gay establishments in the city. One of those missing men was Roger Goodlett. And while the police didn't seem to care that he had fallen off the face of the earth, his family actually did. A friend of Roger's, known as Tony Harris, volunteered to help Goodlett's family look for the man. Not only was Harris helping hang flyers, but he was keeping his eyes open a bit wider than before when he would frequent the gay clubs. And one night, in an indie gay bar, Harris spotted a man at the bar with his eyes locked on one of the missing person posters. This piqued his interest, so he decided to approach the guy. Harris felt it in his gut that this man knew something about his missing friend. Harris was so curious about the unusual man that he struck up a conversation with him, despite the eerie feelings he had. The man introduced himself as Brian Smart. Harris, in an episode of A&E's The Secret Life of a Serial Killer, narrated by one of our top five true crime narrators, Bill Curtis, by the way, said, quote, "One thing led to another, and within 15 minutes, I'm in his car, going to what I've been told to be his employer's home. The man took him on a long drive out into the middle of nowhere, where they arrived at a large house in a secluded area. Harris said the house was dusty and dark, and Smart told him there was no electricity in the house, so they wouldn't be turning on the lights. But despite the darkness, something really creepy caught Harris's eye. There were mannequins placed all over the house. Some of them were posed in odd positions. One was set up to look as if it was taking something out of the kitchen cabinet, even. When Harris asked about the mannequins, Smart told him that the owner of the home didn't want to be alone, so he kept mannequins around to feel like he had company over. The two men then made their way to the basement of the home to take a swim in the indoor pool. Harris said it was then that the man asked him what he was into sexually. The man told Harris that he was into sexual asphyxiation. After some talk and coaxing from Smart, Harris agreed to strangle the man. That's what he wanted, so he obliged. Harris said he choked the guy out, who masturbated until he passed out. He came to rather quickly and then told Harris how wonderful the rush is from being strangled like that. So Harris, a sexually adventurous man himself, allows the man to do the same thing to him. For those who don't know, sexual asphyxia refers to situations where an individual enhances sexual responses with asphyxiation, like strangling, choking. If it occurs during solitary activity, it's called autoerotic asphyxiation. Harris said, quote, "He had a way with his hand on your neck. Once he starts with the process, you don't want him to stop. You want it to continue. He could bring a sort of ecstasy. He told me what turned him on about it was seeing the eyes bulge out of the head, seeing the lips swell up and at times crack, end quote. Harris did enjoy the encounter, but eventually started to fear for his life. Quote, I told him that he was hurting people and that I would be going to the authorities. He laughed in my face and told me that no one would ever believe someone like me. And for some reason, Smart didn't kill Harris. He actually drove him back to the bar and dropped him off. So by this point, the mother of one of the missing men contacted a private investigator named Virgil Vandegrift. The mother hoped that Vandegrift could help her find what had happened to her son. Vandegrift was also contacted by Goodlett's mother to do the same for her. Harris says he then contacted that private investigator and told him that there's a man in Hamilton County, Indiana, strangling people, and his name is Brian Smart. Harris was convinced that the man who could have strangled him to death in that dark mansion is involved in all the missing men in Indianapolis. Vandegrift starts searching for men in the area named Brian Smart, but none fit the description Harris had given him. And there was no way to find the house Harris had been taken to because it was dark and in an area that he couldn't quite describe. Vandegrift was soon at a standstill as no more men went missing for quite some time after that. But he knew he'd strike again. It was clear that this man was a serial killer and was used to getting away with it. He would surely surface again. And he did. In the summer of 1995, gay men started going missing again. Brian Smart also resurfaced in Harris's life. Harris had given the man his number, so he started calling him, asking if they could get together again for a repeat of their first encounter. He also started telling him that he was very familiar with death. He implied he had actually been responsible for many deaths, but never actually confessed to murder. He said that he had had some mishaps or accidents. He seemed to think that sometimes things just got out of control and people ended up dying. Harris understood exactly what he meant. And that is something that often does happen with sexual asphyxiation. People do often accidentally kill their partners or themselves during that kind of sex play. There have been countless people who actually die that way in their own homes. The founder of the band NXS, Michael Hutchence, and actor David Carradine both died that way. Harris and Vandegrift eventually spoke again, and the PI asked Harris to really think about the house and let him know anything that he could remember that might help them find the house or that man. Harris said it was clear that while Smart was driving him to the location, they had entered, quote, rich people territory, end quote. He also noted that he saw some horse farms and remembered that the property the man drove him to actually had a sign that included the word farms on it. So there was a little more to go on now. He also remembered that there was a really long winding driveway. Indianapolis police had the same information as the private investigator, so they did their own search for the house, but they couldn't turn up anything either. And again, they really didn't seem too concerned with, you know, the missing gay men in the area. So Vandegrift took it upon himself and decided to take the Harris information and hire someone to get aerial photographs of properties in what he suspected to be the rich people area. He wanted to see if any of the properties matched Harris's description. So Vandegrift does find a place that looks a lot like what Harris described. So the two men visit the property on the ground and are pretty sure they have found the right place. They look in the windows, they see a pool, inside pool. I don't know if they saw any of the creepy mannequins or not, but I'm sure they did. And that would have told them right there if they had the right place. But there was no evidence to get search warrants for the home or the land. Nobody was home. So they just couldn't do anything. But Vandegrift and Harris decided not to give up. And almost a year later, Harris is out in a bar and actually sees Brian Smart again. Harris asks a friend to follow the man outside and get his license plate number. Harris then contacts the police and they run the plates. The plates come back as registered to Herb Baumeister. That is the same name that came up as the owner of the property Vandegrift and Harris had visited almost a year earlier. So who is Herb Baumeister? Herbert Richard Baumeister was born on April 7, 1947 to Dr. Herbert and Elizabeth Baumeister in Indianapolis. The oldest of four children, Herb was said to have a relatively typical childhood, but by adolescence, he was starting to display some disturbing behaviors like playing with dead animals and urinating on one of his teacher's desks. In college, he once took a date to a football game in a hearse. So just throw in some playing with fire and an overbearing mother, and you've got textbook serial killer in the making. So in 1971, Herb married Julie Sater. The pair would have three children and start a successful thrift store chain called Save-A-Lot. That is not to be confused with the discount grocery stores of the same name. So Herb and Julie bought Fox Hollow Farms just outside of Indianapolis in 1991, following some success of their business. The thrift store chain had really taken off, and so they decided to upgrade their life. On the outside, it looked like they were the ideal family, living the ideal life, the American dream, if you will. But as we all know, things aren't always what they seem. The couple's first problem arose just months after their marriage in 1971, when Herb was committed to a psychiatric hospital by his father. Juliet said Herb was just having emotional problems, but had no idea that Herb was once diagnosed as schizophrenic. But that seemed to be a normal reaction for Julie. There were a lot of things about their marriage and her husband that she didn't question. For example, the couple had been married for 25 years and actually only had sex 6 times. 3 of those times resulted in children. According to multiple reports, Julie also never saw Herb nude. 25 years of marriage and she never saw her husband naked 1 time. She claimed it was because Herb was self-conscious of his body because he was tall and thin. Despite all the red flags, I guess money and kids can make a marriage go a long way. But eventually even the money became a problem. The retail business empire they were building began to fall apart, and their marriage began to become more and more strained. So that leads to the couple spending more time apart. Julie began taking the children to their lake house in the summers of 1993 and 1994, leaving Herb behind. That meant that Herb suddenly had a lot of time to himself in the summer months. So now we know that Brian Smart is clearly actually Herb Baumeister, and he had a lot of spare time during the summers the men went missing. So now would be a good time to mention what happened in early 1995. Herb and Julie's son finds a skull in the woods behind their home. Julie freaks out, but Herb assures her that that skull actually belonged to his father from when he was in medical school. He said an animal probably dragged it from the garage into the woods. And like everything else unusual in their marriage, Julie overlooks it. Again, once again, so many red flags for this poor, missed by this poor woman. So now, armed with the potential suspect's name, police track down Herb at one of his stores. And when they ask him about the missing men, he says he wouldn't know anything about that because, first of all, he's not gay. And secondly, he has never been to a gay club. When the police tell him that they know he was at a gay club because his car was spotted recently at one, he admits to having been there, but said he only lied to them because he's a married man and no one knows he goes to gay bars. But when they asked him if they could check out his property, he refuses. Indianapolis police eventually go talk to Julie. They tell her that they are there to investigate a homosexual homicide. She does not know what that even means. And it's understandable. Why would they call it that? It's like, oh, 1990s, why were you so homophobic? Julie refused to cooperate and sent the police away. But by January 1996, the marriage had become so strained that she filed for divorce. And after taking a lot of time wondering why her soon-to-be ex-husband was being investigated for disappearances of gay men, and remembering the time her son found a skull in their backyard, she would soon have a change of heart. In June 1996, Herb had shut down one of their stores, cleaned out a bank account, and took their son and had gone to the family lake house. Julie then decides to let the police search the property. She shows investigators where the skull was found. As they were standing there talking, one of the officers spotted a bone on the ground that looked a lot like a human humerus. And as others started looking closer, they found human teeth and finger bones. Needless to say, the police were standing on a crime scene. Teams were called in, and an in-depth search began. The remains of 11 different people were eventually found on the property. Julie tells the police that Herb is at the lake house with their son, so everyone grows very concerned about the boy's safety. Julie and her attorney set up an emergency child custody order so police can go to the lake house and take the boy to safety. And that's what they do. But unfortunately, they still don't have enough evidence to arrest Herb. I guess all the bones could have been put on that property by anybody. But when they finally did get enough evidence to arrest Herb, he had already fled to Canada. And after 8 days on the run, his body is found in Ontario, Canada. He had shot himself in the head. And he did leave behind a suicide note where he talked about the failing business and the failing marriage, but he didn't mention the killings or any of the missing men. And the last line in the letter said that he was going to eat a peanut butter sandwich and go to sleep. So of the 11 sets of bones, 8 were eventually positively identified. One of them included Roger Goodlett, Harris's friend. So Herb would never be charged or tried, but there's little mystery when it comes to whether or not he was the man responsible for those missing men and the bones found on his property. But now we get to the part that actually is a mystery. In the early to mid-1980s, 9 men were found murdered in rural areas near Interstate 70 between Indianapolis and Columbus, Ohio. Police have dubbed the killer of these men as the I-70 Strangler, not to be confused with the I-70 Killer. This serial killer only preyed on men, and they were all found strangled to death and dumped nude or partially nude in bodies of water. But one eyewitness would posthumously identify Herb Baumeister as the man seen leaving a bar in 1983 with Michael Riley, one of the 9 victims. So was it possible that Herb Baumeister was also the I-70 Strangler? Everyone seems to think so. And it's unusual for a serial killer to break and change patterns, but it's not unheard of, especially since Herb is sort of an unusual case. He was this kind of lust killer who got off on seeing people reacting to their own strangulation. Profilers had even suspected that Herb's first victim was probably accidental. So after seeing someone die like that, nothing less than that was ever as gratifying. I'm not sure what I think of that, though, because you think back to Herb's childhood when he was playing with dead animals and pissing on people's desks. I just think he would have killed regardless, but he discovered this method, which was far more gratifying to him. He could have used knives or guns, but this was special to Herb. So I think he probably was the I-70 Strangler. And that means that his victim count could have been as high as 20 or 21. But during one of the times Herb talked to Harris on the phone about his, quote, mishaps, the number 50 was mentioned as a possible kill count. Of course, killers always seem to exaggerate their numbers, but it sadly wouldn't surprise me if that many gay men went missing in the 80s and 90s and were never accounted for. And sadly, that's just how it happened. And something else of note, Fox Hollow Farms is still standing and is now a spot for true crime fans who like to take murder tours, but it's probably better known now as a hot spot for ghost hunters. Many people believe that the house and grounds are haunted. Google haunted Fox Hollow Farms if you're interested in a whole other chapter of this case.
I know when you mentioned this case, I hadn't heard of the killer, but then you got to the part about the farm where it was a long winding road and a pool, and then it suddenly clicked. I was like, oh my God, he's talking about Fox Hollow Farm.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not going to say I'm obsessed with it because I don't know every detail, but I watch a lot of ghost shows and true haunting shows. And every one of those hundreds of shows does at least one episode of Fox Hollow Farm.
Yeah, that's what I read. I read that like every show has gone there. And if it's, and people go there to try to get in on their own or whatever, and YouTube it or whatever. It's all over the place, apparently.
And the one haunting I remember, because it's been a while since I've watched any of those shows, they actually tried to get the ghost of Herb to come and communicate with them. So they got a guy who was younger and fit the description of a lot of his victims or alleged victims to go swim in the pool for like an hour.
Oh my gosh.
To see if he would show up.
Trying to lure the gay bait the ghost.
Yes. And it didn't show up on camera, but they said they had eyewitness reports where like people who lived there who had teenage sons or young adult sons would have swimming parties there and they would be held underwater or they would feel like they were choking.
Oh my gosh. Now,
so that's creepy.
So how do they explain that fact that he didn't die there though? Like do ghosts, are ghosts believed to have returned to their like mostly their stomping grounds after death? Or is it, I always thought ghosts haunted where they died.
I do too. I think the theory, and you know, someone can fact check me on this. Like I said, it's been a while since I've watched any of these episodes. I think the theory is that he was going to the place where he felt most comfortable or right. that he relished the most. And serial killers, you know, they collect mementos and they like to go back to those mementos. And that whole farm basically was his memento because all the bodies there.
That's very true. And he didn't even try to hide them. He just kind of let them lay there and rot.
I know, like, this guy's all over the place.
Can I say something about what I think of the spirits of people that have passed and what yeah. they... So I do think places have, like, a residual energy, like if something happened there. But I also think the spirits of people that have died, if they exist, and I think the three of us think they do to some extent, I also think they're not limited by time and space, and they can kind of go anywhere that someone is thinking about them or wanting them to appear. At least that's how I feel.
That makes total sense. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point too. But yeah, so I just, the farm is, it immediately stood out to me.
You know, I'm currently in Louisville, Kentucky, so that's not a far drive for me. I might have to go visit that.
Yeah. I have a question about Fox Hollow Farm, because I had never heard of it before. And I'm sorry if I missed this somehow, but did he actually live there? Why was he there?
Yeah, he lived there, but when he took the guy home, he said it was his boss's place. I don't know why he made up that lie.
Did the wife live there?
Yeah, they lived there. Herb, his wife, and his three kids. The son found a skull in the backyard. She was often at a lake house because they, you know, they had a shitty marriage. They never had sex, and she just left for the summer. And that's when he would go do his thing. Like, cause these things happen in the summer when he was free.
I'm just wondering what the wife thought of the mannequins. I cannot get past the mannequins.
I know. And, you know, I watched like three episodes about this case, and she never once addressed that. And I'm guessing that she kind of like glazed over everything that was unusual in their relationship. So I imagine that he was behind the mannequins, but she didn't care or didn't notice. Or he actually brought them out when they left, and so that he wasn't feeling alone, because apparently he was kind of a hoarder, and whereas he had certain areas that he would collect things like the garage or whatever. And so it was not unusual for there to be something like a mannequin or a medical school skeleton in the garage. So I imagine when his wife and kids would leave, he would probably pull out the mannequins and pose them in various, you know, places throughout the house, which makes them even more creepy.
If somebody drove me to their secluded house and I saw a mannequin posed like it was getting something out of a drawer in the kitchen, I would run screaming.
Right. But instead, that one guy, and I'm going to shame him, but he actually let him choke him out for a bit instead of leaving right away.
I was actually going to comment on that too. Like, what kind of friend is this guy? He was suspicious of this guy anyway, because his friend had went missing.
Yeah.
Then he goes to this house that is so creepy. And then this guy who he kind of thinks might have something to do with his friend's disappearance is like, let me choke you.
Yeah. I mean, you know, they were skinny dipping. I didn't get into all the details that all the sex that was going on and all that stuff. I mean, it was like a complete hookup, you know. First he's suspicious of the guy, and then he decides to lie, sure, take me home.
But it is a little bit odd.
Yeah.
That.
Yeah, absolutely no shame, but I'm sure everybody has that same reaction. So we're not just going to pretend like it wasn't unusual.
Yeah, and was this guy like a smoke show or something? Like what? No. Why is he getting all these people to just let him do whatever he wants without any questions?
Exactly. I would probably go home with him before I would go home with Jeffrey Dahmer in a gay bar, but I would still not. No, you should Google him, or I don't have his picture to send you guys, but you'll see him and you'll be even more confused.
No, on a scale of serial killer charisma from Dahmer to Bundy.
probably just a little above Dahmer. I mean, he looks kind of like, you know, an innocent dorky man. So maybe he didn't seem threatening, but he also doesn't seem like somebody, you know, that'd be, adventurous sexually.
Just enough to go home for the night and just be like, okay, why not?
Maybe a last call hookup, you know?
Yeah. But still not so much that the mannequins would sway you to stay is what
you're saying. No way. Right. No. You know, some guys would be like, oh God, you're weird as fuck, but okay, who cares? No, he's not like that at all. There would be too many red flags, just like the wife should have seen.
Oh my gosh. Talk about the world's thickest rose-colored glasses.
Yes. So, I mean, I think I understand why she might not immediately think her husband's a murderer, because she did say that he had never, you know, laid a hand on the children. He didn't get upset. You know, they would argue. They wouldn't even argue over things. Like, they would just, you know, leave the house. So I understand that, but just there's so many other little things that would have just been like, what the hell's going on? Like, you know, like 6 times, like I understand a lot of people, you know, their relationships dry up sexually and all that, but 6 times in 25 years, that's crazy to me. And I think my first thought would be he must be gay, but especially since he was also, according to one of the investigators that I saw in an episode about him, she said that he was a pretty effeminate man. And I just sent you guys his picture, so now you can react to what you would think if you saw him in a gay bar.
Spooky.
Yeah, I'd have to have several shots in for, like you said, last call kind of thing.
Yeah.
He just, I don't even know how to explain what I think.
Right.
Like, I know exactly what I would feel if I saw him. I'm probably just saying spooky because of what I know now.
Yeah.
If I saw him in a bar, I don't know if that's what I would think, but
I think he's pretty unassuming. Like, he's not, you know, he's not ugly, but he's not, you know, like hot, but he also looks pretty, you know, harmless.
Yeah. He just looks like a mild mannered computer geek or something.
Yeah.
like from that time period.
Yeah. But, you know, he didn't force these guys to leave with him. So it's like the Dahmer thing. Like, how do these guys get guys to leave with them? Like,
He's got some kind of it factor. We just don't know.
I guess so.
I mean, to have that much pull with all these guys and then to have a wife who just doesn't question mannequins in the house.
It's okay. Really odd, the stuff that his wife did not question. I mean, I know there are women that are married to gay men that overlook some clues, but she wasn't just overlooking the clues to him being gay. She was overlooking so many weird things that I just don't understand.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't think I would have bought the story that, oh, that skull was my dad's. Like, I'd have been like, what the hell's going on here? And I would have at least gone and checked it out. You know, I think she did go out there and saw other bones even, but didn't make anything of it. So it's even worse there. But
I feel like if it was a situation where he had a skull that was his dad's for whatever reason, that's something that he would have told her about a long time ago and she would have already known. You don't just find a skull and then it's like, oh, that's my dad's.
You're right. Yep.
I still would have been like, well then let's donate it to, or I'm gonna call the police and ask them what I should do with it since we don't want it in the house.
Yeah.
And then see how he reacted once I said that.
Right. Instead he said he would get rid of it, and she said she checked in a few days and they were gone. So there we go. It's over. End of story.
Yeah, like, I think she just saw what she wanted to see, and based on what their house looked like and the time period, like, it She probably did not want her lifestyle to be
right
disrupted. And if he was a good, attentive father, like you said you saw on one of the shows, you know, a lot of women will sacrifice a lot and look the other way if their spouse is a good parent.
Yeah, she probably liked that money because their family, their marriage really did start falling apart when the business started to go under. I mean, everything else was fine, it seems, until that happened. So I think there's an indication that that's probably why she overlooked a lot of things. And I guess a lot of people do that. Yeah, so I think she overlooked a lot of things for that very reason.
Yeah, and I mean, and it especially in the time that this took place, it was still very common for women to be more dependent on those types of things too. So
yeah.
It's not that we're shaming or anything like that. It's just in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, it wasn't as common for women to be as independent as they are today, if that makes sense.
No, it makes sense. It makes perfect sense. And she had been a journalism instructor, I think, and she quit her job when they got married. So, you know, she was planning to just be, you know, to be taken care of. Of course, she was involved in the business when they launched the business and, you know, did her part and all that. So I'm not saying she didn't, you know, do her part. But yeah, I think that probably had a little bit to do with all the things she overlooked.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think it was more of a, how much am I going to lose? Or is it okay if he keeps the creepy mannequins in the house?
Yeah. Yes, indeed. And he reserved his super creepy time for the summer when they were gone. So I'm not sure what the deal was with the I-70 killings, though. I know they seem to have stopped around the time they moved to Fox Hollow, which would make sense because he no longer had to, you know, pick up guys along the highways or whatever and dump them in the rivers because he could just do it in his house. But he practiced some restraints for a serial killer. Like to have seasons of killing, basically, like that's pretty unusual.
Yeah, it's like he understood, like, okay, this is going to be my peak time, and I got to get it all in before they come back for the winter.
It's so unusual. It's so, and that's one of the reasons why I'm so fascinated by that topic is like how sometimes they go dormant or whatever, and how they can, like, they talk about this nice grinding need to kill, but then they can turn it off for a while. So it's like, why couldn't they just always keep it off, you know?
Yeah, that is a fascinating aspect to me too. Like, I would love to research that more.
Yeah.
But yeah. All I know is if I go to your house and I see the mannequins, I'm out of there.
Yeah, nobody's going to, yeah, no, I'm not going to be staying around anybody's house that are keeping mannequins just hanging out.
Fuck, reminds me of that movie, that horror movie from the early 80s, Maniac.
Oh yeah, it's totally like Maniac.
I mean, honestly, nobody's hot enough to have to put up with mannequins posed in their kitchen.
No.
Definitely not old Herb.
Like, but, I mean, I would hesitate even if it was Henry Cavill or Chris Evans. I'd be like, I really want to go with this.
I was like, I pretend like those mannequins aren't there, please?
I mean, if it was Bob Saget, I could maybe pretend, but...
Well, he can get it, so
yes, he can.
So, what do you guys say we put Fox Hollow Farms on our list of on our road trip list for when we go see the police museum in Cleveland? What was it called? The Torso Murder one?
Yeah, it was the Cleveland Police Museum, and it houses the torso murders, death masks, and then also other really bizarre crimes that took place in the area.
Yeah, we got to see those death masks, and we can put the farm on our tour list.
I wonder if that museum has anything from the Ariel Castro Cleveland kidnapper.
Oh, I bet it probably would. We'll have to. Oh, and a lot of these places too, you can like do a whole tour where you can get like chauffeured around.
I think it's a must on the tour.
Absolutely. Sure. We'll put a pin in that on our map.
Yeah, I'm still surprised that we didn't know about this. Like, that's prolific. Like, that's major. Like,
I know, and that's a high body count. It's not like it was...
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, that is wild. Or the fact that I recognized the house before I did the guy's name.
Right. And I think a lot of people think that it happened a long, long time ago because of the house. Like, I think they know the house and think that whoever is haunting it did their thing like years and years ago. But this was the 90s. Like, it was not that long ago.
Yeah, because anytime they referred to it and they would say a serial killer lived here, I would immediately go back. Like, the most modern time I was thinking would be like the 40s.
Yeah, and they killed like six people or something. But yeah, this guy was major, and that's why I was like, hey, you know, I'm going to do this. It's not exactly a mystery, but he was never charged, and there's that whole I-70 angle. Like, was that really him? You know, so
I think it's... And is the house haunted? That's another mystery.
Yeah, exactly. Perfect, yeah.
It's funny that we all think, the three of us are always like, oh, we're probably going to have to start doing solved cases soon because we're going to run out of cases. I think more and more, like, there's just an endless amount of weird stories out there.
Yeah. Even if it's not completely solved. Like, a lot of mine lately have been like, oh, these people probably did it, but they were acquitted. So that makes it unsolved, you know, and that's
right.
unfortunate, but it fits the bill, you know.
Well, and that's like the last one I just did, the Bible John case. There's a probable person, but we'll never know because the DNA evidence apparently is deteriorated. So they'll never know.
And we'll leave the vanishing off the face of the earth stories to Derek.
Yeah, he's good. He is, Derek, you are the master at finding those.
I don't know how I find so many. Brandon actually sent me one the other day that I've never heard of, and it's fascinating, and it's definitely coming up for me.
Well, I feel like it's your calling. The universe just sends you those creepy stories where people just disappear and we don't know what happened to them.
I don't know why they're so interesting.
I got the creepy gay angle covered. So if you ever need that topic, let me know.
If we ever find a gay case that is like a missing person that's super weird, we're going to fight over it.
Exactly.
I'll moderate. We'll have like a legal hearing on air. Who gets custody of that case?
We might have to share billing that day.